Well, today I want to talk about faith and doubt. And faith is one of the most crucial things, isn't it, of what Christianity involves. And in fact, we often say Christianity is a faith. And we can talk about, governments, instead of saying the word church, they like to say things like faith-based community instead, as though faith is the really central thing of what's going on here. And it is a really important thing. Let me show you how important it is with three very short stories, all from Matthew's Gospel. First one is this: Jesus climbed into a boat and went back across the lake to his own town. Some people brought to him a paralyzed man on a mat. Seeing their faith, Jesus said to the paralyzed man, "Be encouraged, my child, your sins are forgiven." And he heals him physically as well, and off he goes. Here we are, further down the same chapter, another story also from Matthew chapter 9. After Jesus left the girl's home, two blind men followed along behind him, shouting, "Son of David, have mercy on us." They went right into the house where he was staying, and Jesus asked them, "Do you believe I can make you see?" "Yes, Lord," they told him, "we do." And then he touched their eyes and said, "Because of your faith, it will happen." And then their eyes were opened and they could see. And here's the third one, this time from the 15th chapter of the same gospel, Matthew's gospel. Jesus left Galilee and went north to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Gentile woman who lived there came to him pleading, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David, for my daughter is possessed by a demon that torments her severely." Now, this is a Gentile woman, and at that time, culturally, the Jews would not associate with Gentiles. It was a big thing, deeply embedded racist attitude in that society. And it was there at every level of the way they would interact. So the conversation continues, but we'll pick it up here where Jesus responded, "It isn't right to take food from the children and throw it to the dogs." She replied, "That's true, Lord, but even dogs are allowed to eat the scraps that fall beneath their master's table." "Dear woman," Jesus said to her, "your faith is great. Your request is granted." And her daughter was instantly healed. Now, in all three of these stories, there are loads of different things we could take away from them. But the thing that's central to them that I want to focus on today is that in each case, Jesus sees someone's faith and says that because of that faith, he's responding to them. He's giving them the healing that they require. And you can see the same pattern in many other stories through all four Gospels. So then we're left with this crucial question of what actually is faith, this thing that's so important. Well, the Bible actually doesn't define it very clearly for us. It sort of leaves us to figure it out from what we can see from different stories. The closest thing is this thing at the beginning, verse at the very start of chapter 11 of the letter to the Hebrews. And it says, "Faith shows the reality of what we hope for. It is the evidence of things we cannot see." Now, in terms of what it actually means to have faith and to live with faith and to show faith, I'm not sure how clear I find that. It doesn't help me out a lot and think, okay, if I want to come to Jesus with faith, like those three people in the stories that he responded to, then how can I do that by showing the reality of what we hope for and evidence of things we cannot see? I can't quite see how to apply that. Do you see what I mean? So we'll need to pick it apart a bit more to try and figure out exactly what we mean when we talk about faith. Here's what it doesn't mean. It's worth dealing with this, because this is a definition from Richard Dawkins, famous atheist who used to be an excellent science writer and has since basically given that career up to be a professional snark. But here's what he wrote: "Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, or even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence." Now, if you're taking notes, don't write that down and put a big tick next to it. That is not what faith is. That's a complete misunderstanding. And I would say probably a willful misunderstanding. Here's, I think, a much more helpful definition, which I've come back to over and over again. It's from our old friend C.S. Lewis, And what you can do is every time I preach, you can just keep an eye out for when C.S. Lewis pops up and then just make a little mark. And here's what he defined faith as. I find this really helpful. It is the power to go on believing, not in the teeth of reason, but in the teeth of lust and terror and jealousy and boredom and indifference. To go on believing that which reason, authority, or experience, or all three, have once delivered to us for truth. Now that's quite complicated. I'm just going to go through that again and try and lay out exactly what he's saying. What Lewis is talking about here is that faith isn't believing something that there's no evidence for, which is what Richard Dawkins would say. He says that it's something that you've once seen because of evidence. You've reasoned it out, you've understood it, or it's been shown to you, or you've experienced it. And faith is that you go on believing that when you're not feeling it anymore. That's the key thing here. So the examples he gives are when you're overcome by lust or by terror or by jealousy or by boredom or even something as mundane as hunger. You know, if you're really hungry, you can't really think so straight, can you? I know Fiona can't. And what happens is you just kind of slightly lose your moorings in all these situations. And then you don't quite think straight about things. You don't quite necessarily think about people the way you normally would. And faith in this definition, what faith means, is holding on in those circumstances to what you know is true, to what you already understand, specifically about Jesus in this case. Does that make sense? So faith is certainly not the opposite of reason. It's certainly not a matter of ignoring evidence, as Dawkins would have it, but it's actually very much a matter of hanging on to what evidence and reason have shown us. So then we have to ask, where does the power of faith come from? Because it's pretty clear in those stories that there was a power in the faith that the people who came to Jesus had. Now in this picture here, we've got this guy just working at his faith and he's trying really hard. You can see it, can't you? There's almost veins standing out on his arms and he's putting in so much effort to have faith. Now, is that where the power of his faith comes from, because he's putting in so much effort? No, it isn't at all, is it? It's not the power of faith isn't in us at all. It's not because we have faith that there's power. It's because of who we have faith in. The power of faith is in the one that we have faith in. And the reason for that is because ultimately what faith comes down to is trust. In fact, a lot of the while, when you read Bible verses about faith, you could almost substitute the word trust in a lot of cases. It's a matter of who you trust in. Well, you know, if I have faith in... See, I don't know who to name now. There's an example of someone who isn't worthy of my faith, you know. Yeah, well, okay, let's go there. Yeah, if I had faith in the England rugby team. However much faith I had, that didn't make any difference yesterday. Because ultimately the power is not in me, it's in who I have faith in. And that rugby team, when it came to it, just didn't turn up and play on the day. But when my faith is in Jesus, the power is there because he is the one who has the power. So you see what's going on here is I don't generate power with my faith. What I do is I link up to the power that's already there. You can think of faith then as being a connection that we make between us and the one who we trust. So then what is doubt? Now, if you're rushing ahead and filling in your sheets, you may have filled in here, doubt is the opposite of faith, but I don't think it is at all. Unbelief in the Bible is the opposite of faith, and that, if you like, is a refusal to believe. And ironically, it has much more in common with what Richard Dawkins thinks faith is. So unbelief in this case would be refusing to believe a thing even though you've seen it, refusing the evidence of your own eyes because your mind is already made up. So, for example, somebody hears a well-documented account of a miraculous healing attested to by a medical doctor, and if their response is, no, that never happened, because miracles never happen. Now, that's unbelief, and it's not skeptical, as those people would sometimes like to think. It's the opposite of that. It's discounting evidence because it doesn't fit their preconceived ideas. So that's unbelief, That's the opposite of faith. And I would say that doubt is not the opposite of faith, but that it can only exist when there is faith. The notion of doubt makes no sense except when there's faith. Now, I think of doubt as a sort of wavering in faith, a loss of faith, decreasing the faith. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I am saying that it isn't disastrous, because in a sense, doubt is evidence that there was faith in the first place. Let me give you an example of that. Jono at the moment, our youngest son, is working hard on his A-levels. Or is he? Well, the answer is we don't really know for sure, because he mostly works up in his room and he's got all sorts of stuff he needs to do on the computer and composing for music and so forth. And we're not monitoring him moment by moment, but we have faith in him because we know who he is. We know what he's like. We know his character. We know what kind of thing he's doing. So the answer to the "or is he," I'm pretty certain, is yes, he is. He's doing that work and he's doing what's required of him. But there can be doubt in that. So at any given moment, it's perfectly possible that he's playing a video game instead. That's possible. I might doubt that he's, you know, right at this moment that he's, I don't know, writing an essay about the effect of Pinter on 20th century drama or something. Maybe he's not doing that. Maybe he's playing Overwatch instead in that moment. So you can see there's space for doubt in that situation. But that space only exists because fundamentally I have faith in him that he's doing what he should do. See what I'm saying? Here's another example. For years and years, I've had a degree of faith in Andy Murray, a brilliant tennis player who just could not win Wimbledon for one reason or another, year after year. But it was reasonable, based on what I knew about him, based on my reasoning about him, to believe that he probably would win Wimbledon, because he'd won the US Open, he'd been ranked number one in the world, he'd beaten all the top players. So it was reasonable to have faith, based on that evidence and based on reasoning, that he would achieve that particular goal of winning Wimbledon. But also, because I had faith in him, it was also possible for me to doubt. Do you see what I'm saying? So it was possible to doubt that it would ever actually happen, and maybe one way and another it would never quite come to pass. Whereas about someone like Dan Evans, who I think is currently the top-ranked British male tennis player, I've got no faith at all that he'll ever win Wimbledon. Sorry if anyone here is related to him or is a big fan, but you know, he's a good tennis player, but there are whole levels above that I've got no reason to think he's ever going to pass that. So in relation to Andy Murray, I had some faith tinged with doubt, but for Dan Evans, I only have unbelief that he will ever win Wimbledon. Now again, do you see the clear difference here between unbelief and doubt? Very different things. So with all that in mind, what I'd like to do now is look at the story of the disciple Thomas, who we think we call Doubting Thomas. And we'll see how these two different ideas tie in, and we'll figure out how guilty Thomas was and how we should think about him. And we'll just look at his story, see what we can learn from it. Here is that story, and I'm going to read it out. This happens shortly after the crucifixion and the resurrection. So the leaders of the Jewish community at this point are very hostile, not only obviously towards Jesus, but to all of his followers as well. So in this context, here's what happens. That Sunday evening, the disciples were meeting behind locked doors because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders. Suddenly, Jesus was standing there among them. "Peace be with you," he said. Now that's one incident. Now we're going to skip forward a few days. One of the 12 disciples, Thomas, nicknamed the twin, was not with the others when Jesus came. They told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he replied, "I won't believe it unless I see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers into them, and place my hand into the wound in his side." 8 days later, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. The doors were locked, but suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing among them. "Peace be with you," he said. And then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound in my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe. Thomas exclaimed, my Lord and my God. And then Jesus told him, you believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me. Now just think about that in light of what was said about faith, doubt, and unbelief. And as that's turning over in your mind, I'd like to think about this first of all, the different situations that the people in this story were in. Because this is an important factor. Now think about those disciples who are gathered. Two of them were Peter and John. Now they had seen the empty tomb. Because the morning that Jesus rose, they ran down to the tomb. So Mary had told them that it was empty. They ran down and saw for themselves that the body of Jesus had gone. Now, they didn't see the risen Jesus at that point, but they knew at least that something had happened. So that's their situation. But what about Mary herself? Now, we don't know exactly who was gathered in that room at that time. We don't know if it was only the 12 or whether there were other followers of Jesus also present. But if there were, Mary would likely have been one of them. Now, she had actually seen Jesus on the morning he rose. And do you remember the story where she didn't recognize him at first and thought he was the gardener and asked him, where have they laid his body? And only then did she realize that it was the risen Jesus. So she'd actually seen him. Think how different her situation was from that of Peter and John. The other disciples, of course, hadn't seen him then at all. But then partway through the story we just read, they do see Jesus in the locked room. He appears to them all. So they've seen the risen Jesus. So their situation is different again. They've seen him now, but they hadn't before. And then separate from all of that, Thomas's story is different because he missed that incident. He, alone of them, did not see Jesus. And we don't know why he wasn't there. All we know is he wasn't there. This is one of these things where often the stories in the Bible just leave out a lot of background. And if this was told as a novel, we'd have all the backstory. Why wasn't he there? Maybe it was something completely trivial. Maybe it was his turn to go and pick up the donuts that day and he was late because he was bringing them in. Maybe his wife was unwell and he stayed at home to look after her. Or maybe it was something more serious than that. Maybe he was so hurt and so disappointed by the crucifixion that he just couldn't bring himself to keep meeting with his friends and he'd just dropped out completely. Maybe. We don't know which of these things it was. Maybe he'd just given up meeting with the disciples. What we do know is that they all started in very different positions in that situation. And the same is true with us, isn't it? We all start in different situations. We all have different experiences of God. Partly it's our history, partly it's our character. I know some people who seem to live their Christian lives always close to God. And they would be very aware of him, you know, day by day, maybe moment by moment. Honestly, that's not my experience. I'm not like that. Now, I've had some number of experiences in my life when I've been very, very aware of God's presence. But yeah, and for much of my Christian life, what I'm living on is what I know is true based on those experiences, but not on having the experiences over and over. In fact, what I'm living on a lot of the while is pretty much C.S. Lewis's description of faith. I'm continuing to believe day to day what my own experience and my reason has shown to me. And I wonder how many of us are in that situation. How many of us, probably some, have a fantastic experience of relationship with God, and day by day they always feel they're close to him. Others maybe, only rarely. Maybe some of us are going through a really tough, dry time where whenever we pray, whenever we read the Bible, whenever we worship, all of those things, for some of us maybe that just feels like boring, hard work. But you still know what you know, even if that's your situation. So, this definition of faith, the Lewis one that we had earlier, I do find really helpful as a reminder of what it is that I'm holding on to. It's the things that I know are true already. Now, here's the thing with Thomas. He had more reason than most to have that kind of faith, because he had been with Jesus when Lazarus was raised. Now, we know that because when the story of in John's Gospel is told of Jesus raising Lazarus, Thomas is one of the few disciples who's mentioned by name in that story. And in fact, it's pretty much the only other time in the New Testament that is mentioned. So it doesn't look good for Thomas in that sense, because he, of all people, should know that Jesus actually has power over death. He has seen with his own eyes Jesus call Lazarus out of the grave, and up comes Lazarus. So you might say that Thomas, of all people, should have known and understood that the one who had power over Lazarus' death would also have power over his own death. And yet, I don't know, I go back and forward a little bit on how harsh we should be on Thomas. So part of me thinks, come on, Thomas, you should have known better. Then I think what it must have felt like in that situation. How isolating would it be if you've been traveling around with these other 12 guys for 3 years following Jesus, and then that one morning that you're out picking up the donuts, the other 11 all say that they've seen him alive again, and you're the only one who's missed out. How'd you feel about that? I wonder whether any of the other disciples would have done much better if it had been them. What if it had been Thaddeus' turn to pick up the donuts on that morning? Would we basically have the same story in the Bible, I wonder, except instead of doubting Thomas, it would be doubting Thaddeus? Maybe he was as much a victim of circumstances as anything. It's difficult to tell. So if we try and figure out what was going on with Thomas, was he just suffering from a momentary doubt or from deliberate unbelief? We can try and think that through by looking at his words. Now, here are the words that he said, and I'm going to read them deliberately in a kind of toneless way for the moment. You'll see why. I won't believe it unless I see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers into them, and place my hand into the wound in his side. Now, I think those words can have two quite different sorts of meanings. In one meaning, it's just a rejection. It's just no, I'm not having it. I won't be fooled again. Are you taking me for a sucker? And then he's saying, I won't believe it unless I see the nail wounds in his hands. Do you see what I'm saying? It's a rejection. It's unbelief. It's a deliberate choice not to believe. That's one way of reading those words. You can also read the same words as meaning something very different, which is a man who is desperate to believe that the Jesus he loves is alive again and can't make himself do it, and he wants to. I want to, but I'm not going to be able to believe it until I see the nail wounds in his hands. And I think that the text can be read in either of those ways. Either of those things could be true. So we've got, again, here's this difference between doubt, which is regrettable but perfectly understandable, and unbelief, which is a deliberate choice. And it's hard from this passage to know which of the two is in effect here. But there is a clue. Well, it's more than a clue, actually. I think it's a dead giveaway. Here's this. It's the next bit of the passage. 8 days later, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. Think of the courage that would have taken. Now, he was still searching for Jesus in that situation. Why would he have got back together with the disciples if it wasn't that actually, fundamentally, he had faith? He doubted, but he had faith. It's not that he had no trust in him at all, like I have no trust in Dan Evans ever to win Wimbledon. Do you know, if he wins next year, this recording is going to sound so stupid. But it's much more like maybe a time when Andy Murray lost in the final of the Australian Open, and I thought, oh, do you know what, he's never going to do it. And yet, fundamentally, because of what I knew about him and what I'd thought through, the faith was still there. So I think that must have been what was going on with Thomas. Because sure enough, 8 days later, disciples are together again, and here's Thomas with them. Now, socially, that must have been hard as well. You imagine what it was like when they met with Thomas in between, and the other 10 disciples, the 10 surviving disciples, because Judas was gone by this point, would all have been saying, oh, Thomas, it was great. You'd have loved it. You should have been there. Thomas over on the other side going, yeah, okay, I get it. And then probably Peter, who was never the most sensitive guy at the best of times, jumping around going, whoa, that's amazing. Poor Thomas just thinking, come on, man, give me a break. And in that situation, I think Thomas would have thought, well, maybe I will just let this go. I'll stay at home and read a book or something. But no, here he is with the disciples. Why? Because he was searching for Jesus. And fundamentally, that's the essence of what the faith is about, isn't it? That's the one that he believes in. It's the one that he trusts. And that's who he's searching for. So I'm kind of on Thomas's side when you put this all together. And I think it's fair then that he's known as doubting Thomas and not as unbelieving Thomas. Because I think what we saw was a wobble. And what he's found in himself is that ultimately, however disappointed he is, however sad he is, however isolated he feels, actually what he wants is to find Jesus. And that's the essence of faith. So then Jesus comes, of course. The next time they're all gathered together, that time 8 days later, Jesus turns up. Oh, and let's look now at how he responds to Thomas. Well, there are three things that come in. The first thing is he gives Thomas what he needs, which is the evidence. And you remember Thomas had said, unless I put my hands in the holes where the nails were, I'm not going to believe it. And that's what Jesus invites him to do. He appears, Jesus is standing there in front of him, and he invites him, if this is what you need to believe in me, then go ahead. It's a very compassionate thing to do. But then there's the second thing. The next thing Jesus says to Thomas, I think, is really interesting. It's a rebuke. And he tells Thomas to stop doubting. Now, it's not my goal up here to say doubt is just fine. Go ahead, doubt all you want. That's not the thing. It's to put doubt in its proper proportion and recognize it as a failing that we can address rather than as some total disaster. But when Jesus sees that Thomas has doubted, although his very first thing he does is to accept him and to give him evidence and to give him what he needs, nevertheless, he does say, don't doubt. It's me that you're trusting. You can trust me. Don't doubt. And then the third thing is acceptance. And he welcomes Thomas back. He's back in the fold. He's back among the disciples. He's one of that inner group again. Now that's very gracious. I imagine had I been in Jesus' position, I might not have been quite so gracious. I might have said, all right, Thomas, had your chance, muffed it. Out you go. Here's your P45. And I go and get a better disciple from somewhere else. That's not how Jesus does it. And that's good news for us, because I think every one of us is capable of failing at least as bad. And the great thing is, just as Jesus gave Thomas what he needed, then rebuked him, and then accepted him, so that's how he treats us as well. And again, it's a pattern that you see multiple times. It's not just in this one story. By the way, there is a tradition, a Christian tradition, that Thomas went on then to become the first evangelist in India, in the great subcontinent of India. Now, we don't know whether that's true. It's not in the Bible. It's only a kind of persistent tradition. But it's perfectly possible. And I guess the tradition comes from somewhere. And if that is true, what an incredible thing to think that this subcontinent that has a population of 1 billion people was first reached with the gospel by this man who we know for his doubting. Actually, what an incredible person. And that largely comes, because of Jesus' graciousness in welcoming him back. And by the way, one lesson for us there is that we should also be quick to accept people back after they fall. So here's that pattern I mentioned before. We'll see the same three things. When Jesus calms the storm. You remember the story? He's crossing the Lake of Galilee in a boat with his disciples. Jesus is asleep. A storm comes up. The disciples are terrified. They're experienced sailors. They know the wind and waves. They understand when a storm is dangerous. They think they're going to die in this storm. So they wake Jesus up. He speaks a word to the storm and it stops. And the storm is calm. So what happens then? Well, they're the same three things. Firstly, he gives the disciples evidence of who he is by calming the wind and the waves, just as he gave Thomas evidence of his own resurrection. Next thing that happens is that he rebukes them. as he rebukes Thomas. And he says these famous words, "O ye of little faith," that's in the King James translation. So again, he's talking to disciples who have known him for years, who have seen him do miracles over and over again, and who because of that should know who he is. And who, even though they're in a situation that's terrifying, even though their bowels are loosened by the prospect of imminent death, nevertheless, they know who Jesus is, and they should remember. They should have that kind of faith we talked about, that whatever the emotional situation, continues to remember what they know to be true. They know that Jesus is the master of nature. So there's a rebuke there. And having first given them what they need, which is the calm water, he then rebukes them for their lack of faith. And then again, the third thing, acceptance. From there on, he just continues to train those same disciples. He doesn't run it like X Factor, where each week he eliminates the worst disciple. Just try and replace it as we go along. That's not how it goes. You know, once Jesus starts to invest in someone, he's in it for keeps. The only reason anybody ever is lost from Jesus is if they choose to walk away. Comes because Jesus loses interest in them. So as we come towards the end here, the last thing in the passage that we read is Thomas's response to Jesus. And it's this, "My Lord and my God." Now Thomas's response to seeing Jesus at this point is worship. And this is significant because there are not all that many places in the New Testament where people actually worship Jesus. But if anybody ever says to you, "Oh, Jesus never claimed to be God," you know, it's a common thing, actually. People will often claim that's true. It is obviously not true. Because of situations like this one, where Jesus is God, and where his response to that is not to reject it or to push it away or to correct Thomas, but he just accepts the worship. Now, Thomas, having come through his dark experience, his awful moments of doubt, and then finally having seen Jesus, is basically the first of the disciples to get this revelation, to see clearly who Jesus is. You know, Peter has understood chapters and chapters earlier that Jesus is the Messiah, but he hasn't recognized Jesus as God. Thomas does. And ultimately, you've got to say it's because he clung on to the faith that he had, even in the teeth of his doubt, that despite his doubt in the resurrection, he still had faith in Jesus, still returned to him, still sought him out. And he was the one then who saw who Jesus really is. And Jesus told him, "You believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me." Now, it used to be when I'd read through this passage kind of carelessly and I think, "Oh yeah, what he's saying is you're not as good as the other disciples because they did believe in me and you didn't." But it's kind of the opposite, isn't it? The other disciples had seen. So they're not who Jesus is talking about here. Think it through. He's talking about two groups of people. You, Thomas, is one group all on his own. It's a very small group. You believe because you have seen me. That's one group. Here's the other group. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me. Well, who's that? Yeah, it's us. We are the ones who Jesus calls blessed here. We are the ones who have believed without seeing. Now, we have evidence. There are good reasons in the mind alone. If you're the kind of person who likes to think things through, there's good evidence that Jesus is who he says he is. But it's not like having actually seen him the way that the disciples did. Jesus says to us, "You are blessed because you believe without having seen me." And I want to leave you with this, another story about doubt and unbelief. This one's in Mark's Gospel. It's a well-known story. There's a man who has a sick child who needs healing. And he says to Jesus, "Have mercy on us and help us if you can." "What do you mean, if I can?" Jesus asked. "Everything is possible if a person believes." And the father instantly cried out, "I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief." And this is so practical and so reasonable for us. And so right here down on the ground where we are. Because for most of us, we've got a faith, but it's not constant and unbreakable and unshakable and moment to moment and absolute. Most of us are intermittently successful in our faith. And it's easy then for us to look at that and say, do you know what? I just don't have enough faith to be a good Christian. I don't have enough faith to, I don't know, be a small group leader or whatever you might be asked to do. Actually, that's not how it works at all. This guy shows us the way. Now, he was acutely aware of his lack of faith, but he had something. Now, one metaphor would be it was like a seed of faith that grew. And that actually is an image that Jesus uses himself in another place. But another way I like to think of this is when he says, I do believe, help me overcome my belief. That little bit of belief, when he says, I do believe, I think of it as like a spark, and then it catches on a fire. You know, when you build a fire, if you've got tinder and little bits of scraped off bark, just a little spark is enough, and it starts to catch, and it grows, and it becomes ferocious and powerful. And I think that's what's going on here. This guy with his tiny little spark of belief comes to Jesus, not saying, check out my awesome faith. Look how much I believe in you. No. Saying, I do believe, just a tiny bit. I do. Help me, please. Help me overcome my unbelief and help me to grow in faith. And this is a great example for us. You know, however much experience of Jesus we have, however close we feel to him, whatever little fragment we have, what we can do with that is just go to him and say, please increase my faith. I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief.